I rang from her lips as she swayed back, her arms upflung. Natala saw her for an instant, a white figure of fear etched against a great, black, shapeless mass that towered over her. Then the white figure was whipped off its feet, the shadow receded with it, and in the circle of dim light, Natala hung alone, half fainting with terror. From the black shadows came sounds, incomprehensible and blood-freezing. She heard Thallus's voice pleading frenziedly, but no voice answered. There was no sound except the Stygian's panting voice, which suddenly rose to screams of agony, and then broke in hysterical laughter mingled with sobs. This dwindled to a convulsive panting, and presently this too ceased, and a silence more terrible hovered over the secret corridor. Nauseated with horror, Natala twisted about and dared to look fearfully in the direction the black shape had carried Thallus. She saw nothing, but she sensed an unseen peril, more grisly than she could understand. She fought against a rising tide of hysteria. Her bruised wrists, her smarting body, were forgotten in the teeth of this menace, which she dimly felt threatened not only her body, but her soul as well. She strained her eyes into the blackness beyond the rim of the dim light, tense with fear of what she might see. A whimpering gasp escaped her lips. The darkness was taking form. Something huge and bulky grew up out of the void. She saw a giant, misshapen head emerging into the light. At least, she took it for a head, though it was not a member of any sane or normal creature. She saw a great toad-like face, the features of which were as dim and unstable as those of a specter seen in a mirror of nightmare. Great pools of light that might have been eyes blinked at her, and she shook at the cosmic lust reflected there. She could tell nothing about the creature's body. Its outline seemed to waver and alter subtly, even as she looked at it. Yet its substance was apparently solid enough. There was nothing misty or ghostly about it. As it came toward her, she could not tell whether it walked, wriggled, flew, or crept. Its method of locomotion was absolutely beyond her comprehension. When it had emerged from the shadows, she was still uncertain as to its nature. The light from the radium gem did not illumine it as it would have illumined an ordinary creature. Impossible as it seemed, the being seemed almost impervious to the light. Its details were still obscure and indistinct, even when it halted so near that it almost touched her shrinking flesh. Only the blinking toad-like face stood out with any distinctness. The thing was a blur in the sight, a black blot of shadows that normal radiance would neither dissipate nor illuminate. She decided she was mad, because she could not tell whether the being looked up at her or towered above her. She was unable to say whether the dim, repulsive face blinked up at her from the shadows at her feet, or looked down at her from an immense height. But if her sight convinced her that whatever its mutable qualities, it was yet composed of solid substance, her sense of feel rather assured her of that fact. A dark, tentacle-like member slid about her body, and she screamed at the touch of it on her naked flesh. It was neither warm nor cold, rough nor smooth. It was like nothing that had ever touched her before, and at its caress she knew such fear and shame as she had never dreamed of. All the obscenity and salacious infamy spawned in the muck of the abysmal pits of life seemed to drown her in seas of cosmic filth. And in that instant she knew that whatever form of life this thing represented, it was not a beast. She began to scream uncontrollably. The monster tugged at her as if to tear her from the ring by sheer brutality. Then something crashed above their heads, and a form hurtled down through the air to strike the stone floor. 3. When Conan wheeled to see the tapestry settling back in place and to hear Natala's muffled cry, he hurled himself against the wall with a maddened roar. Rebounding from the impact that would have splintered the bones of a lesser man, he ripped away the tapestry, revealing what appeared to be a blank wall. Beside himself with fury, he lifted his saber as though to hew through the marble, when a sudden sound brought him about, eyes blazing. A score of figures faced him, yellow men in purple tunics with short swords in their hands. As he turned, they surged in on him with hostile cries. He made no attempt to conciliate them. Maddened at the disappearance of his sweetheart, the barbarian reverted to type. A snarl of bloodthirsty gratification hummed in his bull throat as he leaped, and the first attacker, his short sword overreached by the whistling saber, went down with his brains gushing from his split skull. Wheeling like a cat, Conan caught a descending wrist on his edge, and the hand gripping the short sword flew into the air, scattering a shower of red drops. But Conan had not paused or hesitated. A pantherish twist and shift of his body avoided the blundering rush of two yellow swordsmen, and the blade of one, missing its objective, was sheathed in the breast of the other. A yell of dismay went up at this mischance, and Conan allowed himself a short bark of laughter as he bounded aside from a whistling cut and slashed under the guard of yet another man of Xuthal. A long spurt of crimson followed his singing edge, and the man crumpled screaming, his belly muscles cut through. The warriors of Xuthal howled like mad wolves. Unaccustomed to battle, they were ridiculously slow and clumsy compared to the tigerish barbarian whose motions were blurs of quickness, possible only to steel thews knit to a perfect fighting brain. They floundered and stumbled, hindered by their own numbers. They struck too quick or too soon and cut only empty air. He was never motionless or in the same place an instant. Springing, sidestepping, whirling, twisting, he offered a constantly shifting target for their swords, while his own curved blade sang death about their ears. But whatever their faults, the men of Xuthal did not lack courage. They swarmed about him, yelling and hacking, and through the arched doorways rushed others, awakened from their slumbers by the unwanted clamor. Conan, bleeding from a cut on the temple, cleared a space for an instant with a devastating sweep of his dripping saber and cast a quick glance about for an avenue of escape. At that instant, he saw the tapestry on one of the walls drawn aside, disclosing a narrow stairway. On this stood a man in rich robes, vague-eyed and blinking, as if he had just awakened and had not yet shaken the dusts of slumber from his brain. Conan's sight and action were simultaneous. A tigerish leap carried him untouched through the hemming ring of swords, and he bounded toward the stair with the pack giving tongue behind him. Three men confronted him at the foot of the marble steps, and he struck them with a deafening crash of steel. There was a frenzied instant when the blades flamed like summer lightning. Then the group fell apart, and Conan sprang up the stair. The oncoming horde tripped over three writhing forms at its foot. One lay face down in a sickening welter of blood and brains. Another propped himself on his hands, blood spurting blackly from his severed throat veins. The other howled like a dying dog as he clawed at the crimson stump that had been an arm. As Conan rushed up the marble stair, the man above shook himself from his stupor and drew a sword that sparkled frostily in the radium light. He thrust downward as the barbarian surged upon him, but as the point sang toward his throat, Conan ducked deeply. The blade slit the skin of his back, and Conan straightened, driving his saber upward as a man might wield a butcher knife, with all the power of his mighty shoulders. So terrific was his headlong drive that the sinking of the saber to the hilt into the belly of his enemy did not check him. He caromed against the wretch's body, knocking it sideways. The impact sent Conan crashing against the wall. The other, the saber torn through his body, fell headlong down the stair, ripped open to the spine from groin to broken breastbone. In a ghastly mess of streaming entrails, the body tumbled against the men rushing up the stairs. bearing them back with it. Half-stunned, Conan leaned against the wall an instant, glaring down upon them. Then, with a defiant shake of his dripping saber, he bounded up the steps. Coming into an upper chamber, he halted only long enough to see that it was empty. Behind him, the horde was yelling with such intensified horror and rage that he knew he had killed some notable man there on the stair, probably the king of that fantastic city. He ran at random, without plan. He desperately wished to find and succor Natala, who he was sure needed aid badly. But harried as he was by all the warriors in Xuthal, he could only run on, trusting to luck to elude them and find her. Among those dark or dimly lighted upper chambers, he quickly lost all sense of direction, and it was not strange that he eventually blundered into a chamber into which his foes were just pouring. They yelled vengefully and rushed for him, and with a snarl of disgust he turned and fled back the way he had come. At least, he thought it was the way he had come. But presently, racing into a particularly ornate chamber, he was aware of his mistake. All the chambers he had traversed since mounting the stair had been empty. This chamber had an occupant, who rose up with a cry as he charged in. Conan saw a yellow-skinned woman, loaded with jeweled ornaments, but otherwise nude, staring at him with wide eyes. So much he glimpsed as she raised her hand and jerked a silken rope hanging from the wall. Then the floor dropped from under him, and all his steel trap coordination could not save him from the plunge into the black depths that opened beneath him. He did not fall any great distance, though it was far enough to have snapped the leg bones of a man not built of steel springs and whalebone. He hit cat-like on his feet and one hand, instinctively retaining his grasp on his saber-hilt. A familiar cry rang in his ears as he rebounded on his feet as a lynx rebounds with snarling bared fangs. So Conan, glaring from under his tousled mane, saw the white, naked figure of Natala writhing in the lustful grasp of a black nightmare shape that could have only been bred in the lost pits of hell. The sight of that awful shape alone might have frozen the Cimmerian with fear. In juxtaposition to his girl, the sight sent a red wave of murderous fury through Conan's brain. In a crimson mist, he smote the monster. It dropped the girl, wheeling toward its attacker, and the maddened Cimmerian saber, shrilling through the air, sheared clear through the black, viscous bulk and rang on the stone floor, showering blue sparks. Conan went to his knees from the fury of the blow. The edge had not encountered the resistance he had expected. As he bounded up, the thing was upon him. It towered above him like a clinging black cloud. It seemed to flow about him in almost liquid waves, to envelop and engulf him. His madly slashing saber sheared through it again and again. His ripping poniard tore and rent it. He was deluged with a slimy liquid that must have been its sluggish blood. Yet its fury was no wise abated. He could not tell whether he was slashing off its members or whether he was cleaving its bulk, which knit behind the slicing blade. He was tossed to and fro in the violence of that awful battle, and had a dazed feeling that he was fighting not one, but an aggregation of lethal creatures. The thing seemed to be biting, clawing, crushing, and clubbing him all at the same time. He felt fangs and talons rend his flesh. Flabby cables that were yet hard as iron encircled his limbs and body, and worse than all, something like a whip of scorpions fell again and again across his shoulders, back, and breast, tearing the skin and filling his veins with a poison that was like liquid fire. They had rolled beyond the circle of light, and it was in utter blackness that the Cimmerian battled. Once he sank his teeth, beast-like, into the flabby substance of his foe, revolting as the stuff writhed and squirmed like living rubber from between his iron jaws. In that hurricane of battle they were rolling, over and over, farther and farther down the tunnel. Conan's brain reeled with the punishment he was taking. His breath came in whistling gasps between his teeth. High above him, he saw a great toad-like face, dimly limned in an eerie glow that seemed to emanate from it. And, with a panting cry that was half curse, half gasp of straining agony, he lunged toward it, thrusting with all his waning power. Hilt deep, the saber sank, somewhere below the grisly face, and a convulsive shudder heaved the vast bulk that half enveloped the Cimmerian. With a volcanic burst of contraction and expansion, it tumbled backward, rolling now with frantic haste down the corridor. Conan went with it, bruised, battered, invincible, hanging on like a bulldog to the hilt of his saber which he could not withdraw, tearing and ripping at the shuddering bulk with the poniard in his left hand, goring it to ribbons. The thing glowed all over now with a weird phosphorus radiance, and this glow was in Conan's eyes, blinding him, as suddenly the heaving, billowing mass fell away from beneath him, the saber tearing loose and remaining in his locked hand. This hand and arm hung down into space, and far below him the glowing body of the monster was rushing downward like a meteor. Conan dazedly realized that he lay on the brink of a great round well, the edge of which was slimy stone. He lay there, watching the hurtling glow dwindling and dwindling until it vanished into a dark, shining surface that seemed to surge upward to meet it. For an instant, a dimming witch fire glimmered in those dusky depths. Then it disappeared, and Conan lay staring down into the blackness of the ultimate abyss, from which no sound came. 4. Straining vainly at the silk cords which cut into her wrists, Natala sought to pierce the darkness beyond the radiant circle. Her tongue seemed frozen to the roof of her mouth. Into that blackness she had seen Conan vanish, locked in mortal combat with the unknown demon, and the only sounds that had come to her straining ears had been the panting gasps of the barbarian, the impact of struggling bodies, and the thud and rip of savage blows. These ceased, and Natala swayed dizzily on her cords, half fainting. A footstep roused her out of her apathy of horror, to see Conan emerging from the darkness. At the sight, she found her voice in a shriek which echoed down the vaulted tunnel. The manhandling the Cimmerian had received was appalling to behold. At every step, he dripped blood. His face was skinned and bruised, as if he had been beaten with a bludgeon. His lips were pulped, and blood oozed down his face from a wound in his scalp. There were deep gashes in his thighs, calves, and forearms, and great bruises showed on his limbs and body from impacts against the stone floor. But his shoulders, back, and upper breast muscles had suffered most. The flesh was bruised, swollen, and lacerated, the skin hanging in loose strips as if he had been lashed with wire whips.
"Oh, Conan," she sobbed, "what has happened to you?"
He had no breath for conversation. But his smashed lips writhed in what might have been grim humor as he approached her. His hairy breast, glistening with sweat and blood, heaved with his panting. Slowly and laboriously he reached up and cut her cords, then fell back against the wall and leaned there, his trembling legs braced wide. She scrambled up from where she had fallen and caught him in a frenzied embrace, sobbing hysterically.
"Oh, Conan, you are wounded unto death. Oh, what shall we do?"
"Well," he panted, "you can't fight a devil out of hell and come off with a whole skin."
"Where is it?" she whispered. "Did you kill it?"
"I don't know. It fell into a pit. It was hanging in bloody shreds, but whether it can be killed by steel, I know not."
"Oh, your poor back,"
she wailed, wringing her hands.
"It lashed me with a tentacle," he grimaced, swearing as he moved. "It cut like wire and burned like poison. But it was its damnable squeezing that got my wind. It was worse than a python. If half my guts are not mashed out of place, I'm much mistaken.
What shall we do?
She whimpered.
He glanced up. The trap was closed. No sound came from above.
We can't go back through the secret door, he muttered. That room is full of dead men, and doubtless warriors keep watch there. They must have thought my doom sealed when I plunged through the floor above, or else they dare not follow me into this tunnel.
Twist that radium gem off the wall.
As I groped my way back up the corridor, I felt arches opening into other tunnels. We'll follow the first we come to. It may lead to another pit, or to the open air. We must chance it. We can't stay here and rot.
Natala obeyed, and holding the tiny point of light in his left hand and his bloody saber in his right, Conan started down the corridor. He went slowly, stiffly, only his animal vitality keeping him on his feet. There was a blank glare in his bloodshot eyes, and Natala saw him involuntarily lick his battered lips from time to time. She knew his suffering was ghastly, but with the stoicism of the wilds, he made no complaint. Presently, the dim light shone on a black arch, and into this Conan turned. Natala cringed at what she might see, but the light revealed only a tunnel similar to that they had just left. How far they went she had no idea before they mounted a long stair and came upon a stone door fastened with a golden bolt. She hesitated, glancing at Conan. The barbarian was swaying on his feet, the light in his unsteady hand flinging fantastic shadows back and forth along the wall.
"Open the door, girl," he muttered thickly. "The men of Xuthal will be waiting for us, and I would not disappoint them. By Crom, the city has not seen such a sacrifice as I will make."
She knew he was half delirious. No sound came from beyond the door. Taking the radium gem from his blood-stained hand, she threw the bolt and drew the panel inward. The inner side of a cloth of gold tapestry met her gaze, and she drew it aside and peeked through, her heart in her mouth. She was looking into an empty chamber in the center of which a silvery fountain tinkled. Conan's hand fell heavily on her naked shoulder.
"Stand aside, girl," he mumbled. "Now is the feasting of swords."
"There is no one in the chamber," she answered. "But there is water."
"I hear it."
He licked his blackened lips.
"We will drink before we die."
He seemed blinded. She took his darkly stained hand and led him through the stone door. She went on tiptoe, expecting a rush of yellow figures through the arches at any instant.
"Drink while I keep watch," he muttered.
"No, I am not thirsty. Lie down beside the fountain and I will bathe your wounds."
"What of the swords of Xuthal?"
He continually raked his arm across his eyes, as if to clear his blurred sight.
"I hear no one. All is silent."
He sank down gropingly and plunged his face into the crystal jet, drinking as if he could not get enough. When he raised his head, there was sanity in his bloodshot eyes, and he stretched his massive limbs out on the marble floor as she requested, though he kept his saber in his hand, and his eyes continually roved toward the archways. She bathed his torn flesh and bandaged the deeper wounds with strips torn from a silk hanging. She shuddered at the appearance of his back. The flesh was discolored, mottled, and spotted black and blue and a sickly yellow, where it was not raw. As she worked, she sought frantically for a solution to their problem. If they stayed where they were, they would eventually be discovered. Whether the men of Xuthal were searching the palaces for them, or had returned to their dreams, she could not know. As she finished her task, she froze. Underneath the hanging that partly concealed an alcove, she saw a hand's breadth of yellow flesh. Saying nothing to Conan, she rose and crossed the chamber softly, grasping his poniard. Her heart
pounded suffocatingly as she cautiously drew aside the hanging. On the dais lay a young yellow woman, naked and apparently lifeless. At her hand stood a jade jar nearly full of peculiar golden-colored liquid. Natala believed it to be the elixir described by Thallus, which lent vigor and vitality to the degenerate Zuthal. She leaned across the supine form and grasped the vessel, her poniard poised over the girl's bosom. The latter did not wake. With the jar in her possession, Natala hesitated, realizing it would be the safer course to put the sleeping girl beyond the power of waking and raising an alarm. But she could not bring herself to plunge the Cimmerian poniard into that still bosom. And at last, she drew back the hanging and returned to Conan, who lay where she had left him, seemingly only partly conscious. She bent and placed the jar to his lips. He drank, mechanically at first, then with a sudden roused interest. To her amazement, he sat up and took the vessel from her hands. When he lifted his face, his eyes were clear and normal. Much of the drawn, haggard look had gone from his features, and his voice was not the mumble of delirium.
"Crom, where did you get this?"
She pointed. "From that alcove, where a yellow hussy is sleeping."
He thrust his muzzle again into the golden liquid.
"By Crom," he said with a deep sigh, "I feel new life and power rush like wildfire through my veins. Surely this is the very elixir of life."
He rose, picking up his saber.
"We had best go back into the corridor," Natala ventured nervously. "We shall be discovered if we stay here long. We can hide there until your wounds heal."
"Not I," he grunted. "We are not rats to hide in dark burrows. We leave this devil city now, and let none seek to stop us."
"But your wounds," she wailed.
"I do not feel them," he answered. "It may be a false strength this liquor has given me, but I swear I am aware of neither pain nor weakness."
With sudden purpose, he crossed the chamber to a window she had not noticed. Over his shoulder, she looked out. A cool breeze tossed her tousled locks. Above was the dark velvet sky, clustered with stars. Below them stretched a vague expanse of sand.
"Thallus said the city was one great palace," said Conan. "Evidently some of the chambers are built like towers on the wall." "This one is. Chance has led us well."
"What do you mean?"
she asked, glancing apprehensively over her shoulder.
"There is a crystal jar on that ivory table," he answered. "Fill it with water and tie a strap of that torn hanging about its neck for a handle while I rip up this tapestry."
She obeyed without question, and when she turned from her task, she saw Conan rapidly tying together the long, tough strips of silk to make a rope, one end of which he fastened to the leg of the massive ivory table.
"We'll take our chance with the desert," he said. "Thallus spoke of an oasis a day's march to the south, and grasslands beyond that. If we reach the oasis, we can rest until my wounds heal. This wine is like sorcery. A little while ago I was little more than a dead man. Now I am ready for anything. Here is enough silk left for you to make a garment of."
Natala had forgotten her nudity. The mere fact caused her no qualms, but her delicate skin would need protection from the desert sun. As she knotted the silk length about her supple body, Conan turned to the window and with a contemptuous wrench tore away the soft gold bars that guarded it. Then, looping the loose end of his silk rope about Natala's hips, he cautioned her to hold on with both hands. He lifted her through the window and lowered her the 30-odd feet to the earth. She stepped out of the loop, and drawing it back up, he made fast the vessels of water and wine and lowered them to her. He followed them, sliding down swiftly, hand over hand. As he reached her side, Natala gave a sigh of relief. They stood alone at the foot of the great wall, the paling stars overhead and the naked desert about them.
What perils yet confronted them she could not know, but her heart sang with joy because they were out of that ghostly, unreal city.
"They may find the rope," grunted Conan, slinging the precious jars across his shoulders, wincing at the contact with his mangled flesh. "They may even pursue us, but from what Thallus said, I doubt it. That way is south."
A bronze muscular arm indicated their course.
"So somewhere in that direction lies the oasis. Come."
Taking her hand with a thoughtfulness unusual for him, Conan strode out across the sands, suiting his stride to the shorter legs of his companion. He did not glance back at the silent city, brooding dreamily and ghostily behind them.
"Conan," Natala ventured finally, "when you fought the monster, and later, as you came up the corridor, did you see anything of Thallus?"
He shook his head.
"It was dark in the corridor, but it was empty."
She shuddered.
"She tortured me, yet I pity her."
"It was a hot welcome we got in that accursed city," he snarled.
Then his grim humor returned.
"Well, they'll remember our visit long enough, I'll wager. There are brains and guts and blood to be cleaned off the marble tiles. And if their god still lives, he carries more wounds than I. We got off light, after all. We have wine and water and a good chance of reaching a habitable country. Though I look as if I'd gone through a meat grinder. And you have a sore..."
"It's all your fault," she interrupted. "If you had not looked so long and admiringly at that Stygian cat..."
"Crom and his devils," he swore. "When the oceans drown the world, women will take time for jealousy. Devil take their conceit. Did I tell the Stygian to fall in love with me? After all, she was only human."
The Pool of the Black One. Into the west, unknown of man, ships have sailed since the world began. Read, if you dare, what Skelos wrote, with dead hands fumbling his silken coats, and follow the ships through the wind-blown wrack, follow the ships that come not back. Sancha, once of Cordava, yawned daintily, stretched her supple limbs luxuriously, and composed herself more comfortably on the ermine-fringed silk spread on the Carrack's poop deck. That the crew watched her with burning interest from waist and forecastle, she was lazily aware, just as she was also aware that her short silk kirtle veiled little of her voluptuous contours from their eager eyes. Wherefore she smiled insolently, and prepared to snatch a few more winks before the sun, which was just thrusting his golden disk above the ocean, should dazzle her eyes. But at that instant a sound reached her ears unlike the creaking of timbers, thrum of cordage, and lap of waves. She sat up, her gaze fixed on the rail, over which, to her amazement, a dripping figure clambered. Her dark eyes opened wide, her red lips parted in an O of surprise. The intruder was a stranger to her. Water ran in rivulets from his great shoulders and down his heavy arms. His single garment, a pair of bright crimson silk breeks, was soaking wet, as was his broad gold-buckled girdle and the sheathed sword it supported. As he stood at the rail, the rising sun etched him like a great bronze statue. He ran his fingers through his streaming black mane, and his blue eyes lit as they rested on the girl.
"Who are you?" she demanded. "Whence did you come?"
He made a gesture toward the sea that took in a whole quarter of the compass, while his eyes did not leave her supple figure.
"Are you a merman that you rise up out of the sea?"
she asked, confused by the candor of his gaze, though she was accustomed to admiration. Before he could reply, a quick step sounded on the boards, and the master of the Carrack was glaring at the stranger, fingers twitching at sword hilt.
"Who the devil are you, sirrah?"
this one demanded in no friendly tone.
"I am Conan,"
the other answered imperturbably. Sancha picked up her ears anew.
She had never heard Zingaran spoken with such an accent as the stranger spoke it.
"And how did you get aboard my ship?"
The voice grated with suspicion.
"I swam."
"Swam?" exclaimed the master angrily. "Dog, would you jest with me? We are far beyond sight of land. Whence do you come?"
Conan pointed with a muscular brown arm toward the east, banded in dazzling gold by the lifting sun.
"I came from the islands."
"Oh." The other regarded him with increased interest. Black brows drew down over scowling eyes, and the thin lip lifted unpleasantly.
"So, you were one of those dogs of the Barakans."
A faint smile touched Conan's lips.
"And do you know who I am?" his questioner demanded.
"This ship is the Wastrel, so you must be Zaparavo."
"I?"
It touched the captain's grim vanity that the man should know him. He was a tall man, tall as Conan, though of leaner build. Framed in his still morion, his face was dark, saturnine, and hawk-like, wherefore men called him the Hawk. His armor and garments were rich and ornate, after the fashion of a Zingaran grandee. His hand was never far from his sword-hilt. There was little favor in the gaze he bent on Conan. Little love was lost between the Zingaran renegades and the outlaws who invested the Baraka Islands off the southern coast of Zingara. These men were mostly sailors from Argos, with a sprinkling of other nationalities. They raided the shipping and harried the Zingaran coast towns, just as the Zingaran buccaneers did. But these dignified their profession by calling themselves freebooters, while they dubbed the Barakans pirates. They were neither the first nor the last to gild the name of thief. Some of these thoughts passed through Zaparavo's mind as he toyed with his sword-hilt and scowled at his uninvited guest. Conan gave no hint of what his own thoughts might be. He stood with folded arms as placidly as if upon his own deck. His lips smiled, and his eyes were untroubled.
"What are you doing here?"
the freebooter demanded abruptly.
"I found it necessary to leave the rendezvous at Tortage before moonrise last night," answered Conan. "I departed in a leaky boat and rowed and bailed all night. Just at dawn I saw your topsails and left the miserable tub to sink while I made better speed in the water."
"There are sharks in these waters," growled Zaparavo,
and was vaguely irritated by the answering shrug of the mighty shoulders. A glance toward the waist showed a screen of eager faces staring upward. A word would send them leaping up on the poop in a storm of swords that would overwhelm even such a fighting man as the stranger looked to be.
"Why should I burden myself with every nameless vagabond the sea casts up?"
snarled Zaparavo, his look and manner more insulting than his words.
"A ship can always use another good sailor," answered the other without resentment.
Zaparavo scowled, knowing the truth of that assertion. He hesitated, and doing so, lost his ship, his command, his girl, and his life. But of course he could not see into the future, and to him, Conan was only another wastrel, cast up, as he put it, by the sea. He did not like the man, yet the fellow had given him no provocation. His manner was not insolent, though rather more confident than Zaparavo liked to see.
"You'll work for your keep," snarled the Hawk. "Get off the poop, and remember, the only law here is my will."
The smile seemed to broaden on Conan's thin lips. Without hesitation, but without haste, he turned and descended into the waist. He did not look again at Sancha, who, during the brief conversation, had watched eagerly, all eyes and ears. As he came into the waist, the crew thronged about him. Zingarans, all of them, half-naked, their gaudy silk garments splashed with tar, jewels glinting in earrings and dagger hilts. They were eager for the time-honored sport of baiting the stranger. Here he would be tested, and his future status in the crew decided.
Upon the poop, Zaparavo had apparently already forgotten the stranger's existence, but Sancho watched, tense with interest. She had become familiar with such scenes, and knew the baiting would be brutal, and probably bloody. But her familiarity with such matters was scanty compared to that of Conan. He smiled faintly as he came into the waist and saw the menacing figures pressing truculently about him. He paused and eyed the ring inscrutably, his composure unshaken. There was a certain code about these things. If he had attacked the captain, the whole crew would have been at his throat, but they would give him a fair chance against the one selected to push the brawl. The man chosen for this duty thrust himself forward, a wiry brute with a crimson sash knotted about his head like a turban. His lean chin jutted out. His scarred face was evil beyond belief. Every glance, each swaggering movement was an affront. His way of beginning the baiting was as primitive, raw, and crude as himself.
"Baracha, eh?" he sneered. "That's where they raise dogs for men. We of the Fellowship spit on 'em. Like this."
He spat in Conan's face and snatched at his own sword. The Barakan's movement was too quick for the eye to follow. His sledge-like fist crunched with a terrible impact against his tormentor's jaw, and the Zingaran catapulted through the air and fell in a crumpled heap by the rail. Conan turned toward the others. But for a slumbering glitter in his eyes, his bearing was unchanged. But the baiting was over as suddenly as it had begun. The seamen lifted their companion. His broken jaw hung slack. His head lolled unnaturally.
"By Mitra, his neck's broken,"
swore a black-bearded sea rogue.
"You freeboaters are a weak-boned race," laughed the pirate. "On the Barakas, we take no account of such taps as that. Will you play at sword strokes now, any of you?"
"No."
"Then all's well, and we're friends, eh?"
There were plenty of tongues to assure him that he spoke truth. Brawny arms swung the dead man over the rail, and a dozen fins cut the water as he sank. Conan laughed and spread his mighty arms as a great cat might stretch itself, and his gaze sought the deck above. Sancho leaned over the rail, red lips parted, dark eyes aglow with interest. The sun behind her outlined her lithe figure through the light kirtle, which its glow made transparent. Then across her fell Zaparavo's scowling shadow, and a heavy hand fell possessively on her slim shoulder. There were menace and meaning in the glare he bent on the man in the waist. Conan grinned back, as if at a jest none knew but himself. Zaparavo made the mistake so many autocrats make. Alone in somber grandeur on the poop, he underestimated the man below him. He had his opportunity to kill Conan, and he let it pass, engrossed in his own gloomy ruminations. He did not find it easy to think any of the dogs beneath his feet constituted a menace to him. He had stood in the high places so long and had ground so many foes underfoot that he unconsciously assumed himself to be above the machinations of inferior rivals. Conan, indeed, gave him no provocation. He mixed with the crew, lived and made merry as they did. He proved himself a skilled sailor and by far the strongest man any of them had seen. He did the work of three men, and was always first to spring to any heavy or dangerous task. His mates began to rely upon him. He did not quarrel with them, and they were careful not to quarrel with him. He gambled with them, putting up his girdle and sheath for a stake, won their money and weapons, and gave them back with a laugh. The crew instinctively looked toward him as the leader of the forecastle. He vouchsafed no information as to what had caused him to flee the Barakas. But the knowledge that he was capable of a deed bloody enough to have exiled him from that wild band increased the respect felt toward him by the fierce freebooters. Toward Zaparavo and the mates, he was imperturbably courteous, never insolent or servile.
the dullest was struck by the contrast between the harsh, taciturn, gloomy commander and the pirate whose laugh was gusty and ready, who roared ribald songs in a dozen languages, guzzled ale like a toper, and, apparently, had no thought for the morrow. Had Zaparavo known he was being compared, even though unconsciously, with a man before the mast, he would have been speechless with amazed anger. But he was engrossed with his broodings, which had become blacker and grimmer as the years crawled by, and with his vague, grandiose dreams, and with a girl whose possession was a bitter pleasure, just as all his pleasures were. And she looked more and more at the black-maned giant who towered among his mates at work or play. He never spoke to her, but there was no mistaking the candor of his gaze. She did not mistake it, and she wondered if she dared the perilous game of leading him on. No great length of time lay between her and the palaces of Cordova, but it was as if a world of change separated her from the life she had lived before Zaparavo tore her screaming from the flaming caravel his wolves had plundered. She, who had been the spoiled and petted daughter of the Duke of Cordova, learned what it was to be a buccaneer's plaything. And because she was supple enough to bend without breaking, she lived where other women had died. And because she was young and vibrant with life, she came to find pleasure in the existence. The life was uncertain, dreamlike, with sharp contrasts of battle, pillage, murder, and flight. Zaparavo's red visions made it even more uncertain than that of the average freebooter. No one knew what he planned next. Now they had left all charted coasts behind and were plunging further and further into that unknown billowy waste ordinarily shunned by seafarers, and into which, since the beginnings of time, ships had ventured, only to vanish from the sight of man forever. All known lands lay behind them, and day upon day the blue surging immensity lay empty to their sight. Here there was no loot, no towns to sack, nor ships to burn. The men murmured, though they did not let their murmurings reach the ears of their implacable master, who tramped the poop day and night in gloomy majesty, or pored over ancient charts and time-yellowed maps, reading in tomes that were crumbling masses of worm-eaten parchment. At times he talked to Sancha, wildly it seemed to her, of lost continents and fabulous isles dreaming unguessed amidst the blue foam of nameless gulfs, where horned dragons guarded treasures gathered by pre-human kings long, long ago. Sancha listened, uncomprehending, hugging her slim knees, her thoughts constantly roving away from the words of her grim companion, back to a clean-limbed bronze giant whose laughter was gusty and elemental as the sea wind. So, after many weary weeks, they raised land to westward, and at dawn dropped anchor in a shallow bay and saw a beach which was like a white band bordering an expanse of gentle grassy slopes masked by green trees. The wind brought scents of fresh vegetation and spices, and Sancha clapped her hands with glee at the prospect of adventuring ashore. But her eagerness turned to sulkiness when Zaparavo ordered her to remain aboard until he sent for her. He never gave any explanation for his commands, so she never knew his reason, unless it was the lurking devil in him that frequently made him hurt her without cause. So she lounged sulkily on the poop and watched the men row ashore through the calm water that sparkled like liquid jade in the morning sunlight. She saw them bunched together on the sands, suspicious, weapons ready, while several scattered out through the trees that fringed the beach. Among these, she noted, was Conan. There was no mistaking that tall, brown figure with its springy step. Men said he was no civilized man at all, but a Cimmerian, one of those barbaric tribesmen who dwelt in the gray hills of the far north and whose raids struck terror in their southern neighbors. At least she knew that there was something about him, some supervitality or barbarism that set him apart from his wild mates. Voices echoed along the shore as the silence reassured the buccaneers. the clusters broke up as men scattered along the beach in search of fruit. She saw them climbing and plucking among the trees, and her pretty mouth watered. She stamped a little foot and swore with a proficiency acquired by association with her blasphemous companions. The men on shore had indeed found fruit and were gorging on it, finding one unknown golden skin variety especially luscious. But Zaporovo did not seek or eat fruit. His scouts having found nothing indicating men or beasts in the neighborhood, he stood staring inland at the long reaches of grassy slopes melting into one another. Then, with a brief word, he shifted his sword belt and strode in under the trees. His mate expostulated with him against going alone, and was rewarded by a savage blow in the mouth. Zaporovo had his reasons for wishing to go alone. He desired to learn if this island were indeed that mentioned in the mysterious Book of Skelos, whereon nameless sages aver, strange monsters guard crypts filled with hieroglyph carven gold. Nor, for murky reasons of his own, did he wish to share his knowledge, if it were true, with anyone, much less his own crew. Sancha, watching eagerly from the poop, saw him vanish into the leafy fastness. Presently she saw Conan the Barakan turn, glance briefly at the men scattered up and down the beach. Then the pirate went quickly in the direction taken by Zaporovo, and likewise vanished among the trees. Sancha's curiosity was piqued. She waited for them to reappear, but they did not. The seamen still moved aimlessly up and down the beach, and some had wandered inland. Many had lain down in the shade to sleep. Time passed, and she fidgeted about restlessly. The sun began to beat down hotly in spite of the canopy above the poop deck. Here it was warm, silent, draggingly monotonous. A few yards away across a band of blue shallow water, the cool, shady mystery of tree-fringed beach and woodland-dotted meadow beckoned her. Moreover, the mystery concerning Zaporovo and Conan tempted her. She well knew the penalty for disobeying her merciless master, and she sat for some time, squirming with indecision. At last she decided that it was worth even one of Zaporovo's whippings to play truant, and with no more ado she kicked off her soft leather sandals, slipped out of her kirtle, and stood up on the deck, naked as Eve. Clambering over the rail and down the chains, she slid into the water and swam ashore. She stood on the beach a few moments, squirming as the sands tickled her small toes while she looked for the crew. She saw only a few at some distance up or down the beach. Many were fast asleep under the trees, bits of golden fruit still clutched in their fingers. She wondered why they should sleep so soundly, so early in the day. None hailed her as she crossed the white girdle of sand and entered the shade of the woodland. The trees, she found, grew in irregular clusters, and between these groves stretched rolling expanses of meadow-like slopes. As she progressed inland, in the direction taken by Zaporovo, she was entranced by the green vistas that unfolded gently before her. Soft slope beyond slope, carpeted with green sward and dotted with groves. Between the slopes lay gentle declivities, likewise swarded. The scenery seemed to melt into itself, or each scene into the other. The view was singular, at once broad and restricted. Over all, a dreamy silence lay like an enchantment. Then she came suddenly onto the level summit of a slope, circled with tall trees, and the dreamily fairy-like sensation vanished abruptly at the sight of what lay on the reddened and trampled grass. Sancha involuntarily cried out and recoiled, then stole forward, wide-eyed, trembling in every limb. It was Zaporovo who lay there on the sward, staring sightlessly upward, a gaping wound in his breast. His sword lay near his nerveless hand. The hawk had made his last swoop. It is not to be said that Sancha gazed on the corpse of her lord without emotion. She had no cause to love him, yet she felt at least the sensation any girl might feel when looking on the body of the man who was first to possess her. She did not weep or feel any need of weeping, but she was seized by a strong trembling. Her blood seemed to congeal briefly, and she resisted a wave of hysteria. She looked about her for the man she expected to see. Nothing met her eyes but the ring of tall, thickly leafed forest giants and the blue slopes beyond them. Had the freebooter's slayer dragged himself away, mortally wounded? No bloody tracks led away from the body. Puzzled, she swept the surrounding trees, stiffening as she caught a rustle in the emerald leaves that seemed not to be of the wind. She went toward the trees, staring into the leafy depths.
Conan?
Her call was inquiring. Her voice sounded strange and small in the vastness of silence that had grown suddenly tense. Her knees began to tremble as a nameless panic swept over her.
Conan! She cried desperately. It is I, Sancha! Where are you, please, Conan?
Her voice faltered away. Unbelieving horror dilated her brown eyes. Her red lips parted to an inarticulate scream. Paralysis gripped her limbs. Where she had such desperate need of swift flight, she could not move. She could only shriek wordlessly.
2. When Conan saw Zaporovo stalk alone into the woodland, he felt that the chance he had watched for had come. He had eaten no fruit, nor joined in the horseplay of his mates. All his faculties were occupied with watching the buccaneer chief. Accustomed to Zaporovo's moods, his men were not particularly surprised that their captain should choose to explore an unknown and probably hostile isle alone. They turned to their own amusement and did not notice Conan when he glided like a stalking panther after the chieftain. Conan did not underrate his dominance of the crew, but he had not gained the right, through battle and foray, to challenge the captain to a duel to the death. In these empty seas there had been no opportunity for him to prove himself according to freebooter law. The crew would stand solidly against him if he attacked the chieftain openly, but he knew that if he killed Zaporovo without their knowledge, the leaderless crew would not be likely to be swayed by loyalty to a dead man. In such wolf packs, only the living counted. So he followed Zaporovo with sword in hand and eagerness in his heart until he came out onto a level summit, circled with tall trees, between whose trunks he saw the green vistas of the slopes melting into the blue distance. In the midst of the glade, Zaporovo, sensing pursuit, turned, hand on hilt. The buccaneer swore.
Dog, why do you follow me?
Are you mad to ask? Laughed Conan, coming swiftly toward his erstwhile chief. His lips smiled, and in his blue eyes danced a wild gleam. Zaporovo ripped out his sword with a black curse, and steel clashed against steel as the Barakan came in recklessly and wide open, his blade singing a wheel of blue flame about his head. Zaporovo was the veteran of 1,000 fights by sea and by land. There was no man in the world more deeply and thoroughly versed than he in the lore of swordcraft. But he had never been pitted against a blade wielded by thews bred in the wild lands beyond the borders of civilization. Against his fighting craft was matched blinding speed and strength impossible to a civilized man. Conan's manner of fighting was unorthodox, but instinctive and natural as that of a timber wolf. The intricacies of the sword were as useless against his primitive fury as a human boxer's skill against the onslaughts of a panther. Fighting as he had never fought before, straining every last ounce of effort to parry the blade that flickered like lightning about his head, Zaporovo, in desperation, caught a full stroke near his hilt and felt his whole arm go numb beneath the terrific impact. That stroke was instantly followed by a thrust with such terrible drive behind it that the sharp point ripped through chainmail and ribs like paper to transfix the heart beneath. Zaporovo's lips writhed in brief agony,
But, grim to the last, he made no sound. He was dead before his body relaxed on the trampled grass, where blood drops glittered like spilt rubies in the sun. Conan shook the red drops from his sword, grinned with unaffected pleasure, stretched like a huge cat, and abruptly stiffened, the expression of satisfaction on his face being replaced by a stare of bewilderment. He stood like a statue, his sword trailing in his hand. As he lifted his eyes from his vanquished foe, they had absently rested on the surrounding trees and the vistas beyond. And he had seen a fantastic thing, a thing incredible and inexplicable. Over the soft, rounded green shoulder of a distant slope had loped a tall, black, naked figure, bearing on its shoulder an equally naked white form. The apparition vanished as suddenly as it had appeared, leaving the watcher gasping in surprise. The pirate stared about him, glanced uncertainly back the way he had come, and swore. He was nonplussed, a bit upset if the term might be applied to one of such steely nerves as his. In the midst of realistic, if exotic, surroundings, a vagrant image of fantasy and nightmare had been introduced. Conan doubted neither his eyesight nor his sanity. He had seen something alien and uncanny, he knew. The mere fact of a black figure racing across the landscape carrying a white captive was bizarre enough. But this black figure had been unnaturally tall. Shaking his head doubtfully, Conan started off in the direction in which he had seen the thing. He did not argue the wisdom of his move. With his curiosity so piqued, he had no choice but to follow its promptings. Slope after slope he traversed, each with its even sward and clustered groves. The general trend was always upward, though he ascended and descended the gentle inclines with monotonous regularity. The array of rounded shoulders and shallow declivities was bewildering and apparently endless, but at last he advanced up what he believed was the highest summit on the island, and halted at the sight of green, shining walls and towers, which, until he had reached the spot on which he then stood, had merged so perfectly with the green landscape as to be invisible, even to his keen sight. He hesitated, fingered his sword, then went forward, bitten by the worm of curiosity. He saw no one as he approached a tall archway in the curving wall. There was no door. Peering warily through, he saw what seemed to be a broad, open court, grass-carpeted, surrounded by a circular wall of the green, semi-translucent substance. Various arches opened from it. Advancing on the balls of his bare feet, sword ready, he chose one of these arches at random and passed into another similar court. Over an inner wall, he saw the pinnacles of strangely shaped tower-like structures. One of these towers was built in, or projected into the court in which he found himself, and a broad stair led up to it, along the side of the wall. Up this he went, wondering if it were at all real, or if he were not in the midst of a black lotus dream. At the head of the stair he found himself on a walled ledge or balcony, he was not sure.